What is catch wrestling?
Catch wrestling is a shortened term for catch-as-catch-can wrestling, which is a style of wrestling that was pretty popular around the turn of the century in America and Europe. And it was a style of grappling that included both what we might recognize today as the wrestling style that you would see in an amateur wrestling match, but it also included a healthy dose of submission holds or concession holds, which were designed to make your opponent quit on the spot without having to trouble yourself with a pin. And so that aspect of it was more reminiscent of what we might see today in a Brazilian jiu-jitsu or a submission grappling tournament.
Did I understand any of that? I will before the program's over. Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast all about authors from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with Chad Dundas about his novel, Champion of the World. This novel opens with a great sentence. The clowns came to get him when it was time for the hanging. It's set in 1921, somewhere in California, I think, in the first chapter. Tell us about Pepper Van Dien and what he's doing in chapter one.
Sure. Pepper Van Dien is a fellow who at one point was a big star in the world of legitimate professional wrestling. But for reasons that are not immediately clear to you at the beginning of the book, he's fallen on hard times and been blackballed from the sport of wrestling. So he and his wife, Moira Van Dien, have taken up with a traveling circus. And so they travel the country pursuing various jobs for this traveling carnival. And Pepper Van Dien's job is really twofold. For starters, he performs a dangerous act in the middle of the carnival's main performance, which is called the hangman's drop trick, where he is literally hanged by the neck from a rope. And then his other job with the carnival is that he wrestles open weight challenge matches against all comers as part of the carnival's athletic show, which takes place after the main performance, and basically involves him wrestling any local man or boy who thinks he's tough enough to slap down a nickel and climb into the ring with a guy who used to be the lightweight wrestling champion of the world.
Is the hangman's drop something people actually used to do?
Yeah, the hangman's drop is a real carnival performance that was perfected by wrestlers and strongmen around the turn of the century. The most famous practitioner of it is probably Martin Farmer Burns, who was a pretty well-known wrestling trainer and himself a wrestler around that time. And as the legend goes, he was so enraged at losing a wrestling match to an opponent who beat him with a chokehold really early in his career that he devised a system for training the muscles in his neck so that that would never happen again. And he got to the point physically where, at least according to the stories, he could withstand a 3 or 4 foot drop from a platform with a noose around his neck and hang for 3 minutes and whistle Yankee Doodle Dandy, which I'm sure you can imagine was much to the delight of audiences in the early 1900s.
It's mentioned in the book that Pepper Van Dien is an expert in something called scientific wrestling. What does that mean?
Scientific wrestling is just a piece of wrestling industry jargon that would refer to someone who is very adept at the technical aspects of wrestling, meaning that you could say he is a true wrestler's wrestler. He doesn't just get by on his physical acumen. He has a tremendous understanding of leverage and physics and the technical moves that it requires to be successful in wrestling, which is really a necessity for him since he's kind of a small man. But scientific wrestling is just a kind of a turn-of-the-century bit of terminology that refers to the actual physicality and technical acumen of a wrestler.
And that comes into play later in the novel when they get to Montana. But in the meantime, Pepper's wife also works for the carnival, and I'd like you to read a passage that introduces us to her.
Sure. The longshoreman was dressed for an evening on the town, in a leather vest emblazoned with the seal of his union chapter, and a silver bear claw belt buckle holding up his herringbone slacks. His red hair hung loose to his shoulders, and the single gold tooth in his mouth glinted under the lights each time he won a hand of five-card poker. With the big clock in the gaming pavilion creeping up on 7:30, Moira Van Deen folded a pair of kings and let him take down a lukewarm pot with the tens she knew he had hidden. As he raked another stack of chips into his lap, the longshoreman blew her a kiss. Some men just didn't know how to win without making a spectacle of themselves. For the first half of her shift, she had managed to make nice, letting the longshoreman win hand after hand without so much as a knowing laugh or an, "Oh, I do declare." This, though, was too much. As the next hand began, she showed him the honest, square John grin she knew was best for taking people's money, and he looked back like he wanted to sink his teeth into her. "Now the little lady is ready to play cards," he announced, as if they were all about to watch a monkey try to tie its shoes. The rest of the sleepy-eyed drunks slouching around the table chuckled along with him, each of them watching her with the usual mix of boredom and animal lust. She wasn't fooling anyone. In her apricot evening gown and beaded amber necklace, they knew she was the carnival shill. They all thought she was there to keep them company and to see that the carnival got its 5% rake out of every pot. In truth, her job was more about making sure the action at the table didn't lag, that chips moved from one side of the table to the other at a brisk pace, and that they all continued ordering the watered-down highballs the carnival sold in paper soft drink cups for 50 cents apiece. Any money she collected went back to the carnival's kitty, so her job was also to win a few hands from time to time, just not so many that it disrupted the game or the men gave up. In addition, she was there to cut any company losses, to make sure nobody won too much money. If one of these dock workers and two-bit grinders proved sharp enough to put together a big stack of chips, Moira was tasked with winning some of it back. It was not challenging work. Once the evening performance got underway across the carnival lot, only the worst men remained inside the gaming pavilion. It would take a team of plow horses to drag any of them away before all their money was gone. Gaming Pavilion was what the employees of the Markham and Markham Overland Carnival were required to call it, though it was really just a weathered 20x20 canvas tent, battened by yellowing sidewalls and domed in the middle with a thick wooden stake. It smelled of damp wool and trampled grass, the ground cold under her open-toed shoes. Electric lights were set up on poles in all four corners, and under the clamor of the men drinking and writhing and giving away their savings, you could hear them buzzing. The game was standard stud poker. Each player got five cards, three up, two down, with a series of betting rounds between. By the time the dealer got three cards into the next hand, most of the men at the table had folded, leaving just Moira and the longshoreman to play heads up. The dealer flopped the longshoreman a jack of clubs as his fourth card, and when he bet on it like a bull charging for a matador's cape, Moira fought down a smirk. One look at the longshoreman's drunken, bloodshot eyes told her he had a hand that he liked. She signaled the dealer by putting both of her elbows on the table, and the dealer gave her the high sign to fold, idly touching the knot of his necktie with the tips of his fingers. Before she made a move, she chewed a fingernail and let her eyes stray nervously around the table, wanting the men to think she was uncertain. Finally, painfully, with her head tipped slightly to one side and her mouth pinched in a regretful scowl, she pushed in her cards. "Fold," she said. The longshoreman made a clucking sound with his tongue and swept up another meager pot. "Cowardly," he said. She bit her lip. She wanted to tell him she knew he was holding at least one more jack, that he had her pair of fours beat all to hell, but instead she just frowned into her lap. The longshoreman flipped his cards to show off three of a kind, and she clamped her hand over her mouth, wide-eyed, hamming it up. The men shifted in their seats, embarrassed for her, and as the dealer began to shuffle again, they busied themselves counting their chips, congratulating the longshoreman with the looks of men who believed it should have been them. "For your trouble," the longshoreman said, plucking a 25-cent chip from his stack and flicking it across the felt at her. When she explained to him that she was not allowed to take tips from players, the longshoreman sneered. "Take it as a loan," he said, letting the chip lie. "When I bust you, maybe we can work out some form of repayment." Right then, she should have taken her chips and walked away. She could have let one of the other girls take over the poker table and switch to dice or even blackjack. It would have been the smart move. But sometimes, the card player in her got the better of her good sense.
Somebody else getting the better of her good sense doesn't happen to Moira very often in this book. She's a pretty smart cookie.
Yeah, I would say that she was the biggest, most pleasant surprise of writing this book, because for whatever reason, some of the other characters like Pepper Van Deen and maybe Garfield Taft came to the page a little bit more fully formed in my mind. They were just there when I started writing. But I knew from early on that I didn't want Pepper Van Deen to be alone. I didn't want him to be isolated and just this sort of lone wolf raging against society. I thought that it would be more interesting and more believable if he had a partner in life, if he was married. And so I started trying to come up with a character that I thought would work as his partner. And I knew that she would have to be an incredibly smart and an incredibly able character if she was going to hold her own on the page with this guy who is very kind of over the top and headstrong. So I started kind of toying around with the idea of her as the daughter of this car dealer who grew up on a steamboat and who considered herself to be a very highly adept gambler, and that she would be kind of clear-eyed and sensible to Pepper's sort of hot-headedness, and to feel her come alive as I started tinkering with that character and writing this book was the first time as a writer that I've really had the experience of a character not necessarily taking over, but certainly coming to inhabit the world in such a fully realized way that they feel almost real to you. And I don't know that she necessarily took over the book, but she became every bit as formidable as Pepper Van Deen or any of the other point of view characters in the book.
Oh, I think it worked really well. And somehow you managed to not only balance the partnership between Pepper and Moira, but you showed how much in love they were, even in spite of all the terrible things they went through.
Oh, well, thanks. Yeah, they're a tricky couple. They are very much in love, but they've encountered so much adversity in their lives, and I think that their, at least part of their worldview, leads them to be somewhat brutally honest with each other from time to time, even if they're not necessarily brutally honest with themselves. And they are both like sharp-tongued and quick-witted, and so they were a lot of fun to write. Their relationship really makes up the backbone of the book thematically. And so it was really important to me that it would not only hold up and seem realistic, but also be entertaining for readers who might not have been as drawn to the wrestling aspect or some of the other themes in the book.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't like wrestling, and I loved the book.
Oh, well, thanks so much. I appreciate that.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Chad Dundas about his novel Champion of the World. You can listen again or share this conversation with a friend from our blog. You'll find us online at mtpr.org/twq. Links to our podcast and Facebook and Twitter pages are also there. We'll be back in less than a minute, and when we return, we'll find out how wrestling launched a popular U.S. president's political career. Don't go away. Pepper and Moira are abandoned by the carnival owner early in the book and end up living in a small cabin in a hunting camp near Butte, Montana, where Pepper has been hired to train a heavyweight wrestler, an African-American heavyweight named Garfield Taft, whom you mentioned before. But Taft is not very cooperative at the beginning. What are the forces in play there?
Well, Taft is an ex-con who has recently gotten out of prison, and at one time he was an undefeated heavyweight contender in wrestling and is a very gifted athlete, and he certainly knows that. So he is in this position where he is trying to overcome an almost insurmountable obstacle and become the first African-American to receive a shot at the World Heavyweight Championship at the time. And so he has a lot of confidence in his own ability. So he is not predisposed to take much direction from a coach. But he is also, wrestling with some of his own demons. He has a kind of complicated relationship with his white wife, and he is recently out of prison and is harboring some secrets that are not clear, you know, at the beginning of the book. So he is a character who is both very headstrong and also very sensitive and vulnerable. So those things kind of act together to influence how he interacts with the world.
You included a few details about African-American wrestlers in the plot of this novel at that time. I mean, just enough for us to understand the prejudice and fear they had to face in the sport. What did you learn about that when you were doing your research?
The sport of wrestling was every bit as segregated as the sport of boxing at the time. In fact, what they called the quote-unquote color bar at the time in wrestling may have been even more stringently held than the one in boxing. And in fact, when I started doing research for this novel, I found that black wrestlers had been so marginalized during the late 1800s and early 1900s that it's hard to even find historical accounts of any of them. So in certain ways, I had to borrow a little bit from boxing to make the African-American characters in this book feel organic, I think, to the plot. And I had to borrow a lot from the life story of Jack Johnson, the African-American heavyweight boxing champion in the early 1900s. And certainly he makes up a lot of Garfield Taft's character in this book. But yeah, in wrestling, just as it was in boxing, the athletes at the highest level and the promoters who were charged with, protecting the sport, as they would say at the time, were not admissible to allowing an African-American man a chance to take the sport's top prize.
And why was that?
Racism, for starters.
What were they afraid of?
They were afraid that the sporting public would turn away from the sport if it had an African-American heavyweight champion, just as, you know, a lot of whites did during Jack Johnson's title reign over boxing. And obviously that's very much of its day and very wrong-headed, but I think those were the factors at play in the sport at the time.
Mm-hmm. Prohibition and the smuggling of alcohol from Canada into the U.S. are also part of this story. And one of the characters is named James Eddy, and he's in charge of deliveries of illegal alcohol to the hunting camp where Pepper Van Deen is supposed to be training Garfield Taft. Why is James Eddy there, and what's supposed to happen with the alcohol?
Well, yeah, James Eddy is a gangster from Chicago who also suffers from undiagnosed obsessive compulsive disorder. And he has fallen out of favor with his own crime boss in Chicago, an Irish gangster by the name of Dion O'Shea. And they're kind of lifelong friends. They came up together through the streets. But Eddie got himself into some trouble in Chicago and needed to get out of town for a while. And so O'Shea signed him up for the army and sent him to World War I, where he got some training that becomes invaluable to his career as a criminal, but also put him on the other side of the sea while Dion O'Shea was coming into his own as a gangster. So he returns to Chicago kind of out of the loop and feels like he's been passed over by his best friend in the you know, the art of running this criminal enterprise. And so James Eddy believes, kind of as a way to shuffle him to the side, Dion O'Shea has sent him to Montana to safeguard this ongoing smuggling effort to bring whiskey in from Canada. And what they are basically doing is stockpiling it in this old barn in an out-of-the-way location close to Butte, where when they feel like they need it in Chicago, they can really easily load it on a train and ship it back there in very expeditious fashion. So James Eddy is the top guy in the organization in Montana, but at the same time feels very marginalized by a person he considered to be a lifelong friend.
Yeah, he's a city boy, and now he's been exiled to rural Montana. One of the things that he notices early in the story is something that is described in this quote: "A man could get away with anything out here if only he could find something worth getting away with," which is not only an example of foreshadowing, I thought, but doesn't that kind of describe the writer's dilemma? Fiction writers face this big empty space, like James Eddy was looking out over the valley that there was nothing there, and then the writers figure out what they can get away with.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I tried to include at least some of my own struggles in this book, and so, you know, as you read through the struggles of these wrestlers and gangster characters, subtly, some of what I'm trying to poke at is the difficulty and dilemma of writing. And I really wanted Montana to be a big part of this book and to make it feel atmospheric and to have that rugged and enormous landscape affect all of these characters kind of in different ways. And Pepper Van Deen is a character who's kind of from the area. He spent a lot of time in Idaho as a child. So he is, you know, is somewhat used to the Rocky Mountains and kind of feels at home there. And I wanted the character of James Eddy, who, as you said, is a city boy from Chicago, to have kind of the exact opposite response. And frankly, the exact opposite response that a lot of people in the modern world have to Montana, where they're just kind of taken by the majesty and the physical beauty of it. James Eddy finds the wide open spaces to be, in an ironic way, kind of suffocating for him. So I wanted to play around in a couple of different ways with the physical landscape of Montana, and I wanted it to affect this particular character in kind of a negative way.
In the historical notes section at the end of the novel, you wrote that several famous U.S. men were avid wrestlers, including George Washington and Abraham Lincoln. What were the circumstances of a wrestling match in their day? Why and when and how would a guy like George Washington wrestle?
Well, I think wrestling was, you know, certainly a more popular sport, particularly in the 19th century and then the early part of the 1900s. It was a more accepted part of daily life, perhaps because of the ease of competition. Like, you didn't need a lot of equipment to be a wrestler, so it was easy for someone like Abraham Lincoln to dabble in wrestling, certainly easier than it would have been for him to scrape together all of the equipment to be like a noted baseball player at the time. And it certainly rose to popularity when the idea of physical health and what they, you know, physical culture, as they called it at the time, started to become a bigger part of people's lives. And I think, frankly, there's just something about it that appealed to sort of rough and tumble men of that era, like Abraham Lincoln is portrayed to be these days. And indeed, there's a story of him kind of launching his local political career at home by winning a high-profile wrestling match, that was one of the first things that sort of launched Abraham Lincoln to notoriety in his hometown and home state and allowed him to kind of set sail in the political world because people knew him as this big, tough guy who had won this wrestling match.
I bet he had great leverage.
Sure, yeah. He would be an extremely difficult physical puzzle for an opponent.
How did it go from something like Abraham Lincoln or Teddy Roosevelt wrestling somebody to this huge thing that we see on TV today where everything's staged and scripted and it's just this kind of big media circus thing?
Yeah, well, that is the multi-million-dollar question. Because as I said before, wrestling was a very popular and hard-nosed legitimate sport through much of its life into the early 1900s. But sometime in the late 19-teens and the dawn of the early 1920s, you start to see the formation of what we consider today to be the modern sporting culture. And the attitudes of spectators started to change. People started to become more interested in spending a pleasing afternoon at the baseball field or going out to see a college or professional football game. They started to become less and less interested in spending an evening in a crowded, smoky ballroom watching what would inevitably turn out to be a four-hour, quote-unquote, scientific wrestling match, which was really just, you know, a slow-paced slog that to the untrained eye could look just like two guys lying on top of each other for hours and hours at a time. So that started to happen. The moods of modern audiences started to change. And then, you know, Frank Gotch, the popular heavyweight champion of the time, had basically cleaned out the rest of the heavyweight division. And then he retired at a very young age, went back to his farm in Iowa, and died rather suddenly. So wrestling found itself in this predicament where audiences weren't necessarily that interested in it anymore, and it had just unexpectedly lost its top star. And so that created a lot of anxiety for promoters of the day. And at some point, some either very forward-looking or dastardly wrestling promoters, depending on how you think about it, got together and made a gamble that they could make more money by faking it than they could through the real thing. And so what we know as the modern form of professional wrestling was born. And perhaps the most interesting and potentially ironic thing to me is that it turned out they were absolutely right, that the public was far, far more interested in fake wrestling than it was in real wrestling. And so, you know, nearly 100 years later, we have this over-the-top scripted morality play on television, which worldwide turns out multi-billion dollars in profits for the people who control it.
Crazy. What else do you want to say about the book?
I hope that the book is entertaining to people. You know, even people, like I said, who don't come to it thinking that they're wrestling fans. When you sit down to write a book about professional wrestling in the early 1920s, the last thing that you think is this is going to be huge and everybody's going to love it. But there is a lot of stuff in the book that I think modern readers can really dig into. Aside from the wrestling, you know, there's a couple of love plots. There are is some bootlegging. There's a little bit of crime. There's a little bit of you know, race relations, as you said. There's a lot of gender relations going on. And so I hope that people who don't like wrestling can find that they spend a pleasing few hundred pages in the lives of these characters. And I hope that people who do like wrestling feel like I did justice to the sport at the time.
Chad Dundas lives in Missoula, Montana. Look for more information about him and sign up for our podcast at mtpr.org. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a terabyte of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana, bringing Montanans together to learn and reflect for 40 years. And by listeners like you. The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridas. You'll find links to our podcast and Facebook and Twitter pages at mtpr.org.